Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tech Can't Save Us. As always, I'm your co-host, William Gadsby P.
I'm Rebecca Hedman.
And I'm Paul David, joining y'all from beautiful Mexico. I get the tough assignments.
Paul has a very lovely sort of Aztec rug behind him that looks very on point.
On brand.
Yeah, if you were just like eating tacos and drinking a margarita right now, it would really complete the sort of look.
Next time.
Yeah, next time in sunny Puerto Escondido. Before we jump into the full pod, if you are listening, please do like, subscribe, make sure to check it out and review it on whatever platform you're on. It's super, super helpful for us, gets the pod out to a wider audience, so I would really appreciate it.
So yeah, on today's pod, we're going to be discussing diversity in the tech industry, a topic that is very much near and dear to our hearts as a diverse content and digital marketing strategy firm that specializes in tech for good companies. You've heard the stats, you've seen the news, and it's something that, you know, we're working on as an industry. And to help us discuss that and to bring some expert insight, we've got Rocio Van Nierop from Latinas in Tech, who we're very excited to have on the pod today.
Yeah, let's get to the main topic for today's pod. So, you know, we've just celebrated the month of Pride, and while always a glorious occasion and a lot of fun, I think our industry still needs to sort of be wide-eyed and address many of the diversity issues that we're facing, you know, across all of our society, but particularly in tech. You know, it feels like a lot of the pay gaps, opportunity gaps that are prevalent throughout our society are dialed up even further within tech. We work in the industry every day, and it is still predominantly a white men's club. So yeah, just taking us to some of the specific numbers and stats to give you an idea of the scope of the problem we're facing. Almost half of all women in tech drop out of the industry by the age of 35. Only 35% of people working in tech are from any form of minority ethnic background, and only 28% of the workforce are not men. These are stats for the UK, but they're actually quite often even worse as you look across the US to many other countries in the world. So I think the first question for me is, what do we think is driving this? Like, why are we here? Why is there such a disparity in tech that we don't see in some other industries?
I think a lot of it comes back to hiring. You know, we saw coming out of 2020, people made a lot of these like pledges for like giving money. You know, one thing that the folks at Content is Queen, the folks who are the wonderful producers of our podcast, have talked about is all this money got proposed after 2020 to boost, you know, podcasting and like the involvement of women in podcasting tech and things like that. And now 3 years on, like where's the money? Where are the pounds, so to speak? So I know that Amriel Morgan has been working really hard with that and has been spearheading a campaign to kind of ask folks where the dollars are. Back to the point about hiring, I think a lot of folks, they don't make it a point to make it a priority. They sort of say, hey, broadly, they put out these like broad mission statements, they put a nice shiny PDF together, but they don't actually track like they would their production schedules or client budgets and things like that. They don't systematize it. So I think that's one big thing is, you know, it's like, cool, you can send me your PDF. And actually had this happen the other day, a potential finance firm we were working with were like, what's your DEI policy? They sent me a nice shiny PDF. And then I looked at their team page and there was like one black face on the team page, you know, of like, you know, 50 people. So it was kind of like, all right, put your money where your mouth is, put your nice shiny policy into practice. And yeah, like, how do you track it? So I think there's like, just a lack of willingness, unfortunately. And a lot of people trying to use DEI and diversity as like, window dressing, but like under the hood, they're like, okay, we're going to keep doing things that they want to do. So that's sort of the dark side, the sad side of it, I think.
Yeah, I think there's like two separate strands there that I think you touched on, which are both key. Like, one is there has been a lot of posturing, but then not real policemen to like be like, okay, well, you said you were going to do this, have you actually done it? And I think we are actually starting to see some positive change there. Like McKinsey and a few other consultancy firms are really starting to put people's feet to the fire when it comes to sort of their hiring quotas, their sustainability policies, just generally all the stuff that people say they're doing but aren't really doing. So I think there is finally sort of that, here's the police that are actually going to call you out when you are just lying about the things that you're doing to improve DEI or sustainability or whatever it is, but in particular racial and gender equality in hiring. And I think as well, there's probably a more wider cultural issue that I think maybe we finally turn the corner in, but like, I think it almost goes back even along with hiring, like to school. There's biases in schools that like, you know, sciences and maths are like male subjects, and then arts and stuff like that are female subjects. And like that really is like something we're only just kind of getting teachers and educators out of the mindset for. But all of that infrastructure that's in place, like if we've only just convinced teachers that maybe women could be scientists or data analysts, you know, that just tells you how walled off those gardens are already. So even if we do send more women from school down to some of these tech focused companies, you know, that stat about half of all women in tech dropping out of the industry, like it's clear what they're finding when they get there. Like it's male dominated, it's probably misogynistic and unaware of many of the sort of like microaggressions around race and gender that, you know, are just the day-to-day reality of those organizations. So I think, yeah, it's almost you have to start all the way back from education and through hiring, and then also sort of have watchdogs keeping people honest when it gets to the actual makeup of their company.
Yeah, and I even agree with you about the schooling and education, because I think even before you get as deep as to the gender presumptions in schools of what girls and boys should be doing, I think that some schools, especially in like schools in poorer areas, they are encouraged to take vocational routes and are not encouraged to actually pursue any kind of tech industry. They're more like focused on vocational practices. And I think that's a huge issue in London, especially like I can only speak for London because that's where obviously I've grown up and probably like yourself as well. But I think that that is one of the key issues. We have all of these tech hubs around the UK and a lot of push in areas like Scotland or the Midlands where there are universities. And I think if we look at the schools in inner city London, they're not raising any awareness about tech. And really some of these children like myself are not aware about the tech industry until you get into college or university level. So I think that's something that we really need to address, because I'm sure that in any grammar schools or like kind of like privately educated schools, that's something that the children are exposed to from an earlier age. So before they can even get to a point where they can say, this is what I want to do, they are aware of those industries. They are encouraged to pursue gaming, pursue software engineering and pursue coding. So I think that even before you look at what girls and boys are encouraged to do at kind of a later stage, the government need to address the curriculum in all the schools and kind of give the children a level playing ground. Because, you know, just like, for example, if you look at football sports, how many great footballers come from not a great background because that is kind of seen as like not a vocational but accessible thing for all. So I think that that's an interesting perspective, and I would be intrigued to see in the future how that could be applied. Paul, you mentioned on our last pod episode about swapping out the old curriculum for new things, and I think that that's definitely something that could be helpful in mending that gap.
Yeah, I was intrigued by like this piece that we're reading from the FinTech Times about like, you know, just the, I'm always thinking about HR and hiring and stuff like that with the agency and stuff like that, but sort of like what different offerings render in terms of increasing the number of applicants from, you know, different communities, particularly women. So the study that they did, you know, where they looked at, you know, over 210 tech employees in the UK and showed that like 88% of them reported offering flexible hours, but, you know, how offering things like part-time working, job sharing, condensed hours, remote working. Obviously we run a 4-day work week at Literal Humans and that has a huge effect. So I think there's like a major issue here on the front end of like, how are we creating spaces that are inclusive? You know, like we talk about the D all the time and like DEI, but like there's something that you said about like, how is that space that person who, if you do hire someone from a diverse community, they ultimately land in, is that place inclusive for them? Do they feel like they can meet their caregiving responsibilities? Do they feel like they, you know, see their cultural holidays or, you know, different things represented in your yearly calendar and things like that? I think that's really important, because even if they get in the door, I think we're seeing a lot of folks churn through these organizations because they're like, this place isn't for me. It's not speaking my language. It's not like, you know, connecting to my community in any meaningful way. And that's really unfortunate. So
yeah, I think your point about football is so interesting. Like that's something we do tell kids from rougher backgrounds, this is for all. And look how all of like England's best football stars are quite often young black kids from inner cities, like of London or Manchester or Leeds. So if you give them that opportunity in tech, like imagine what they do. Yeah, I think that's
the kids on the streets of Brazil, you know, you see them videos go viral all the time of like these amazing footballers. So I just think, imagine the magic or the tech that could be developed if we really push that in these third world countries or even, you know, closer to home. But Paul, to your point about like an inclusive space, I know that you guys sat down with AJ Mpu on one of our episodes and she spoke really candidly about being a woman in the tech industry and how her experience of coming into places and being hired and not actually seeing an environment that was reflective of her personal situation, how that inspired her as a founder. And I think that it's a really important point that you raise, because coming into a space, you can't thrive if you're not comfortable. And I think that's really important. And as employers, like, I've never been an employer, I've never employed anyone, but I can imagine as an employer, like, you guys must know it's really important to meet your employees on that level. And I think even Ajem Poo spoke about her experience as a mother, which I thought was really insightful, and how a lot of the tech industry meetups or like events were after work. And she was trying to find the balance of like managing her motherhood with that. So I think that's a really interesting point, because we often think about the hiring process, but we don't think about how making the hired people or employees comfortable afterwards, or meeting them on a level in some way. And especially in the tech industry, it could be difficult. But I think it's very interesting that you raised that.
I think like one of the most knucklehead things that we ever did when we were starting the agency was like, we had a team member who was practicing Islam, and you know, during the month of Ramadan, we scheduled like a team lunch and sort of totally forgot that the person was fasting and sort of like didn't integrate that cultural understanding into our planning. And we were kind of like, oh my gosh, like this person, you know, Shakir, a lovely team member who was very gracious and very accepting of our many apologies about this, was like, oh, it's fine, guys. Like, I get it. Like, you know, it was very open to us, like still having a team gathering, but just those little things of like, hey, maybe we should do something different. Maybe it should be sort of like a walk in the park or like a bowling outing or something like that. Maybe it's not like a food focused team gathering during the month of Ramadan when you know you have team members who are practicing and fasting and things like that. So like integrating those things that make the space, and broadcasting that too, and saying like, hey, we do provide accommodations for team members who are fasting during Ramadan. Do we offer period leave? You know, like Spain is pioneering the way in terms of having period leave, menstruation leave for women who experience like really difficult and challenging, you know, periods, like integrating those into your HR policies and stuff like that. I think signals to people on the front end, and that's what the FinTech Times piece was talking about, like, hey, like not only will we hire you, but once you get here, this is like a welcoming space for you. And I just think there's such an opportunity for tech, like, you know, there's such pioneers in so many other ways that they've got this flexibility, they've got the money for sure, and they could do it. It's just a kind of a matter, I think, of will at the end of the day. And I think it's a matter of the leadership, like having that sense, like, if the leaders of these tech firms like don't have diverse personal and professional networks, they're probably not going to hire diversely, right? If they don't have personal, you know, diverse personal and professional networks, they're very likely to not understand like what the hell Ramadan even means, and that people are going to be fasting, and that maybe they should account for that, right? Because it's not in their sort of social sphere. So, I mean, we'll get to solutions a little bit later, but I have some ideas about that.
Yeah, I do think that to that point on culture, it's just so often, even if you do care and you hire like diversely, whether it's a woman, whether it's someone from a Muslim background, like the example we were talking about with Shakira, if they come in, the predominant culture is like, hey, we're all men and we meet up after work and we get pissed, and that's what the company culture is. And genuinely, that is, for I would say 90% of companies, that's what the team culture and the company ethos is. Even with like a hiring team and chief leadership that cares, they'll bounce and you'll be like, I don't understand why, you know, they never came to any of the drinks and stuff. And it's like stupid shit like that why people churn. Like you have to change things around. So it's like, okay, cool, we now have, you know, a young Muslim woman who doesn't drink in our organization, so the team company meetup, like, yeah, it doesn't always have to be built around her, but like there should always be non-drinking options. There should be a non-drinking version that we do to make it inclusive.
And even just like creating a work environment where if she felt uncomfortable, she feels comfortable enough to say, hey guys, this one's not for me.
Yeah.
And doesn't feel like, oh, you know, she can't say anything or voice of her opinion. So I think that you guys creating that space where she actually felt comfortable to come forward and voice her opinion and her perspective is equally as important as finding other things to do than like meet up. Because it's cool to like meet up for a drink. People like to do it. It's part of British culture. But I think just having that space where she could say, you know what, this is not for me, I think that's equally as important.
And to be fair, yeah, for the stuff where we were gonna like meet up in a pub or whatever, she'd just come and have a Diet Coke and like sit and have the crack joke and have a great time.
Yeah.
But you know, is finding that way to include people, and yeah, that sort of trust where like, you know, me and Paul had fucked up and made a mistake, but like she knew that we were trying, and so like, it, you know, there's that two-way trust between you that means you can then make sure you don't make the mistake next time.
Mm.
Taking us back to the original question of like, what is driving a lot of this inequality in tech? I think one of the big drivers is actually VCs and startups, and a lot of the problems that are, you know, prevalent in tech are very much amplified larger within the VC world. 75% of startup founders come from advantaged socioeconomic backgrounds. Like, that is really bad. Like, that, like, you know, that's not even like white, Black woman, man, that is 75% of startup founders in the UK come from affluent backgrounds. That's like what, like the top 15% of people in our society are responsible for 75% of startups. That is awful. And another one, 2/3 of all UK unicorns have a worse pay gap than the national average in terms of lines of gender and race. Those are pretty terrible. You know, they track with a lot of US focused stats we've seen, like the one that you always hear in the US is, which has actually gotten worse, which is just fucking shocking, is only 1% of people who receive VC funding are people of color. So it's a bigger problem in the VC world. And I think that drives a lot of the problem we see in tech. Like, you know, VCs invest primarily in tech. That's the industry that's been hot for the last 20 years. They're responsible for who gets the funding. And they're the ones driving forward a lot of this bias and a lot of this sort of self-perpetuating cycle. So what do you guys see in terms of like how those barriers for folk from disadvantaged socioeconomic backgrounds are in place, and like, you know, what could we do to remove them at the VC level? Because if you fix it at the VC level, it very quickly filters down into the world of tech.
And even Carl Loco of the Black Seed, he also comes from kind of a disadvantaged background. And I think that sometimes, not even on a level of race, if we just remove race for a moment, which obviously is hard to do sometimes, but if we just remove race, just seeing somebody who comes from a background who doesn't necessarily hasn't been given kind of maybe the best start in life and seeing that they're able to go forward and be fruitful, it's very inspiring and motivating. And I think even when we're working at agency level, when we get to partner with, you know, all these great people, it gives you a motivation and a real kind of depth of understanding that although these tech industries may not see it, they really do filter down and trickle into every single aspect of life. And we spoke already earlier about the schooling, so I won't go back into it. But I think, again, you know, for young children or people that want to get into the tech industry and may feel scared or nervous, because it's a nerve-wracking industry. Like, let's be honest, even for myself coming into the tech industry, it's nerve-wracking because you don't have the knowledge, you're not used to it, you haven't been around it. So seeing, you know, people come from this type of background and actually achieve, it gives you hope, it gives you motivation. It gives you that little bit of confidence and courage to actually voice your opinion and try to get an understanding. So that's kind of my thoughts on it.
Yeah, I think, Rebecca, it's really good of you to flag like your own experience as like a woman of color and like a mother, like coming into the tech industry. And like there's I think a lot of gatekeeping and a lot of knowledge hoarding. You would think like for an industry that's all about sort of like, you know, like discovering the truth and like, you know, new innovations and things like that, that they would have come up with better ways to like onboard people into their own industry and like give people, you know, a pathway into like learning and just like understanding what's happening and things like that. Because of any industry, like they want all the talent that's going to bring diverse perspective, that's going to lead to breakthrough innovation. So it's kind of like a bit of just like a fascinating paradox of tech that it's like can be so sort of closed and stuff like that. So I think there's like an onboarding issue and kind of like a welcoming issue. I also think the question of like the VCs, like who are the VCs, you know? And I think like you just get a lot of these folks who come right out of finance and come right out of banking and things like that. They're the ones with the capital. They're the ones who start up the VC funds. And so it's like, there's like a superstructure problem of like who, because of how our economy is structured, like everything is tilted towards like finance and capital and investment and things like that. Then those people have the disposable income to then become VCs. There's like a larger societal superstructure problem of who even gets the money because of how our society is structured in terms of taxes and government regulations to become VCs. And then they're the ones who then start to, you know, like swipe the sword on both sides of people, as it were, and you know, knight people as like, okay, you're going to be the founders of the future. And they're totally coming from this investment capital finance perspective. So that's going to render specific results as well. I think what's promising is, like Rebecca, you mentioned Black Seed, there's Harlem Capital, there's all these different organizations. We had Tong Gu from PACT on Well, that they exclusively fund, you know, women founders and stuff like that. I think those solutions are both like, they're great, but they're also, they can sort of reify like the same mindset, because they're like, oh, they've got it, right? Like the PACTs of the world's got it. So like the big venture firms don't have to do it, that we don't need to fund as many women because PACT is going to do it, or we don't need to fund as many Black folks because, you know, Harlem Capital or Black Seed is going to do it. And I think we want to be really careful about that. So like, how does the VC industry start to hold itself accountable? Like all VCs should be saying like, look, if you're an American VC and you know that 15% of the population of America is Black folks, then 15% of your investments should be going to Black founders. And we're going to hold ourselves accountable, just like the American Medical Association or whatever, you know, collective body would hold each other accountable to that. And diversity should be one of the metrics. It should be part of return on investment. But unfortunately, we're just not at that point yet. But I think, yeah, some of those niche programs are promising, but they're also debilitating in a way, not themselves, but in terms of how the sector receives them, is like, oh, the diversity box has been ticked by these folks. I don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, I do think, controversial as they are to some people, the only thing that really moves meaningful change is quotas, quotas that are actually stuck to. And people can get pissy, then get their fucking panties in a twist. But at the end of the day, that's like repeatedly across so many use cases, that's what actually drives change. Like, Labour Party put a quota in place saying that they wanted more women in the party. They almost immediately got more women in the party. Like, they got rid of it, and then they started to see more white men ending up in the party. Like, it's just, it's a simple equation that whether it's VCs, tech, you know, literally insert industry, just do that and you'll, that's the quickest, hardest impact you can make. We've spoken a lot about the problem and various drivers of the problem, but just want to kind of move us on to like why this is such a big issue. I think this often gets lost in the conversation. Like, you know, it, like Paul said, it often becomes a bit of a box ticking exercise. But the reasons that this is so important are pretty extensive and pretty well documented. Yeah, I mean, like, for you guys, what are some of the biggest reasons that diversity matters in tech?
Oh, I think it's really important because not only does diversity mean that you have a difference of perspective, but going back to hiring, when you have diversity in a company or even in a particular industry, you kind of give yourself the chance to access a really wide pool of talent. And I think by companies being closed off and being closed-minded to having diverse people in their team, they ultimately cut themselves off from the talent. Because, for example, say you're a company and you're only looking to hire in London, you miss all that talent that's out there globally. And you can attest to this, Will, and yourself as well, Paul. If you were both closed-minded and decided that you were only going to hire from the US or London, we would miss the exceptional talent that we have in South Africa. We would miss the exceptional talent that we have in Barcelona. So I think that not only does lack of diversity mean that there is a shortage of opinion and preference in the company, it means that you won't access the amount of talent that's out there to be used.
It's a bit banal and like boring to kind of talk about these stats all the time about, you know, diversity in tech, but like, you look at the Boston Consulting Group, where they found that more diverse management teams have 19% higher revenues due to innovation. And so it's like, it's not just a matter of fairness, it's also a strategic advantage. But also, you just get tired of mentioning stats like that, because, you know, it's so clear the benefits of diverse teams and things like that in terms of innovation, in terms of, you know, improved revenue and things like that. But also, yeah, you just wonder like why people haven't latched on to the economic incentive and things like that. But and yeah, I think it's just like more voices in the room leveraged strategically results in, for us, like more interesting content, you know, more well-rounded perspectives about like what could go into the product and service. I think we've seen it in some of our engagements, like actually having, you know, clients from the African diaspora work for a client like Chipper Cash or one of the, you know, a fintech unicorn, you know, out of the African continent, and being able to say, hey, we can actually give you writers who can speak to, you know, the ideal customer profiles that you're pursuing is so powerful, and not something that a lot of agencies, you know, would normally be able to deliver for a client like Chipper Cash, but we were able to do it, and it allowed them to, you know, grow into kind of unicorn status as a result. So I think it's like, it's both a moral issue, it's a representation issue, it is a, you know, strategic and fiduciary imperative. I just think like the reasons are so clear.
Tied to all of that is just what the lack of innovation you get if only one group is represented in your industry. Like, to Paul's example of Chipper Cash, there is a really just like straight up racist policy of almost every bank in the world, every major bank, that you just block transfers to any African country because they assume it's a scam. Maybe in the one, like, out of 10 situations where that is the case, cool, you've saved your customer money. But in the 9 times out of 10, you're like literally stopping the economic development of entire swathes of like the African continent. And Chipper Cash just went, well fuck this, let's just create TransferWise and allow you know, money into countries like Nigeria, Kenya that struggle. And it's just like, no white man would realize or understand that problem. And along with, you know, missing out on, again, all the moral reasons and for doing that, the ridiculous untapped amount of money that you can make off of that. Like, even if you don't give a flying fuck about it for the moral reasons, like, the entire continent of Africa was being badly serviced by the existing financial industry. Like, to solve that problem is and become a unicorn is just like, yeah, like, you white-led VCs completely missed that opportunity to make money just from the fact that they didn't have enough diversity and innovation within their talent ranks. Like, that's what you end up with. It's not just the sort of lack of representation. education. It's the lack of problem solving for problems that you don't know exist. And if you can solve, you can make an insane amount of money. There's like no angle of attack that it makes sense for the predominant sort of like system to just carry on. It just fails everyone, and it's the worst of all worlds.
Yeah. I mean, my whole thing with this too is like, I think what was so powerful about the events of 2020 was that like people were made to feel accountable by what was happening around them, you know? And I think like, I think that's and obviously we don't want, you know, what happened. We don't want, you know, like a horrendous, you know, police brutality and things like that to occur again. But I think the more interesting question is like, how do we create context in these different professional communities where people do feel like their colleagues are, you know, for lack of a better phrase, like kind of looking over their shoulder or tapping them on the shoulder and saying, hey, like, show me this data. Show me what you've done in terms of diversity and inclusion internally, like, you know, and actually saying like, this is a professional responsibility as a community. And so that they actually feel what they felt in 2020, where they're like, man, I've really got to move on this because people are watching me. I got to post about it. Like, even if it is kind of a, you know, tick box exercise, like, you know, moving them from, okay, tick box exercise to actually, I made this commitment at the top of the year and I want to be at this place at the end of the year. And people are going to hold me accountable for that. Like, that to me is the most interesting question about diversity in tech is like, how does the tech community hold itself accountable and who's going to do that right now? I think, and you see some nonprofits and charities who kind of do these assessments where they look at tech companies and they measure them and they say, hey, here's how you are not living up to your commitments. I think an interesting analogy is in the LGBTQ community. I forget what organization it is. I want to say it's GLAAD, but they basically have like a listing where they, you know, monitor and they measure companies in terms of their accessibility and their openness for the LGBTQ community. And every single year they put out a report and you say, these are the top 100 companies that you should be buying from. Here's the companies that are doing a terrible job. So like, what could that look like in tech of like, you know, some sort of clearinghouse where people are saying, all right, we're actually going to measure you. And if it's just an independent measure, fine. But I think that would be really interesting in terms of a potential solution.
Yeah. Just the final point on sort of importance before we dive fully into solutions is the importance of diversity in tech along for all everything else we're talking about is like, tech is becoming more and more prevalent in everyone's day-to-day life. With the advent of AI, it's only going to get worse. And the people who build, as we've already seen, build that tech, if they're all from one demographic block, they inherently put their biases into the tech and into the algorithms and into the software. No one who is sane thinks we have a balanced or just society. Like, you really have to start to, like, have a focus on this. Otherwise you could very easily see a world in 20 years where you have this like completely technophile society where most things are run by AI or tech, and the tech has all been built by white men. So obviously, even if they're not meaning to, it advantages white men even more than they already are. So yeah, I do think that bias and building bias into systems, it's already something we kind of see with law, with accounting, but for it to become like literally built into your phone, built into your laptop, built into everything you use to interact with the world around you, I think that's a very scary and dystopian future that we have to avoid at all costs.
And I think even moving out of like theory or even kind of like thought process, it can be extremely dangerous for people's lives on a day-to-day. For example, if we look at bias in the medical sector, you know, it affects every kind of group apart from the white males. So that, you know, that's women, that's people of color, that's people who have kind of like alternative gender norms, you know, people are being misgendered or not recognized. And that's by way of kind of the software and the technology and things that have been built kind of, I don't want to say prehistoric because it makes it sound like thousands of years old, but prehistoric to what's going on day to day. So it can have very real and serious consequences for people's lives on a daily basis. And I think, especially in a sector like healthcare, that's something that we really need to address because it's now, it's imminent, and it's scary, and it makes people feel unheard. And yeah, it just can be super, super dangerous.
So we've covered on a lot of gloom, but let's end with a silver lining of hope. Like, we've already had some good solutions recommended, but like, yeah, for both of y'all, what do we think we can do to actually solve the issue of diversity in tech? We've sort of already spoken about quotas and VCs. What else do we need to do to solve this problem?
I think tech loves data, you know what I mean? So I think just like having much more, like thing I mentioned just previously, like having much more of a agreed upon sort of clearinghouse for data and like what's our baseline for diversity in tech right now, but also what are our goals for every single year. What I would have loved to see come out of 2020 is like, cool, here's where we are with diversity in tech across all measures, and here's how we're going to measure ourselves every single year. I think there's like a big problem in terms of like, we don't know what we're shooting for. Like when are we going to reach a point where we're like, cool, like diversity in tech has been sorted. Great. Like we've done it. You know what I mean? Like, what does that even look like? That's a very interesting, like kind of curious moment. So what do we mean in terms of like success or equity, or, you know, what does true inclusion look like when it comes to diversity in tech, I think is a really interesting question. So yeah, there's some sort of like benchmarking and data clearinghouse, I think, where, you know, everyone kind of looks at it and says, hey, this is the gold standard in terms of how we measure ourselves with diversity in tech, is I think like just like a table stakes baseline thing we need to do, whether it's a report we look at, you know, at the end of the year or what have you. But I think it's like, you know, what are the equivalent of like the Oscars, the Tonys, or the Emmys, like for what people are doing with diversity in tech, and then sort of the measurements, you know, underneath that.
Yeah, I think like that kind of clear-eyed conversation about diversity, like one of the other things we just need to solve is like that fear a lot of people and governments in particular have around intervening. Like they don't want to admit there's a problem and then put their hand on the tiller, because then, you know, some large blocks of voting people from that demographic that are being advantaged tend to lose their shit. Like, you know, in the US and the UK, there's ridiculous controversy over sort of, you know, education quotas, hiring quotas, that kind of thing. When they have been implemented, you know, the right loses their shit and is like, oh, this is just racism the other way. And like, no, that's such, you know, we won't get into it. So there's that cultural shift as well, where like governments have to be pressured and armed with the incentive to intervene and really, you know, put grants, put quotas in place, offer, you know, the training and education and systems that the industry needs to thrive, and just, yeah, actively intervene in it rather than sort of going, oh, well, this is tech's problem and I don't want to get involved.
And I think before the government can do that, they need to reflect what they're trying to enforce. I mean, at present, we have a government who's trying to enforce certain policies, certain rules that, to be honest with you, it kind of says like, who are you to talk? Because they're not very inclusive in, not by representation. I think we have a very representative government. We have government that represent people from a range of different backgrounds, but the policies don't reflect that. And I think even when we look at the kind of sanctions that they're trying to impose when it comes to immigration and work visas, and even kind of this recent thing we've had where they tried to enforce this Rwanda policy that got rejected by the Supreme Court, like, yeah, praise be. I think that things like that don't help when it's like the government are trying to put their two cents in and it's like, well, look what you're doing. So yeah, they need to kind of be the example and lead by example in that way. I think that that would be super helpful, definitely.
To Paul's point about like changing the curriculum for education, like the Conservative Party have spent the last 10 years trying to make the UK education system be like, oh, how great were the 70s? Like, it's, you know, and that's what you're competing with, and you're trying to fucking get them to teach coding in school. So yeah, it's just, you are bashing your head against the wall in regards to government intervention with our current government, I think.
Yeah, I appreciated the piece from Forbes here about just like a shortage of tech talent, and kind of looking at programs like Academy and what they're doing to broaden like the pools of people and like where they come from. I think that's another important solution as well. It's just like we talked about this when we were talking about the London as a tech hub and sort of other places around the UK sort of broadening the knowledge cauldrons, which we talked about, said we'd never talk about again, but here we are.
You brought it up, man.
He loves it secretly. I quite like that phrase.
It's because it's the last thing he thinks about before he goes to sleep. Fucking knowledge cauldrons.
Yeah. Bitter about it. But like, I think one of the, you know, I've heard once before that like, it's not necessarily like that, you know, certain networks for communities that aren't well represented in tech don't exist. It's that it's the persistence of, you know, networks of privilege where like you hear about that job from, you know, daddy's uncle who works at like said tech firm and stuff like that. And you're the first one in the door. You're the first application there. Maybe they don't even run a hiring process and things like that. So like, how do we like get underneath that? Which I think is really, really hard and really, really complicated. But putting a lot of these programs at the doorstep of these companies and saying like, cool, you have a partnership with, you know, WYK Digital or Academy or, you know, some kind of like Kickstarter program where folks are already with you for an internship. So it makes it that much easier to hire that person full time or to, you know, kind of move forward and bring that person on, I think is really important. You know, knocking out that question of like, do you have access to these people? Are you even in the same, you know, community as them? Do are you aware of them? Just like taking that question off the table entirely and giving people, whether it's a database or like a training program or, you know, some kind of like apprenticeship where that person is there in front of them learning in real time, and then they can bring them into these roles, I think will make a huge difference.
I think that's a really cool idea, kind of like to your point earlier, Rebecca, like vocational schools, but for tech, where it's like, hey, you don't have to go to university, like come take like, you know, 3-4 years of like on-hands tech experience. And we've partnered up with like some of the big tech companies Paul just mentioned. So you're guaranteed to get 2 years of on-the-job experience. Like that would be awesome to start seeing. And to be fair, I'm sure that there are sort of people leading the way in that regard in the UK and US education system, but for that to become more prevalent, because normally vocational schools are like, hey, here's the tools to become a plumber or a tradie, which is absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with those professions, but it'd be cool to see that diversity of tech as well in the mix.
I would have loved to do something like that.
I've also seen some interesting stuff too around like creating structures where people who, you know, get like, you know, tons of referrals or get more work than they can handle, they specifically commit to referring out to underrepresented groups about that work. So I know like Havas, for example, one of the big media companies that's, I think they're US-based, but they have a global presence. They really committed to this where they basically said, hey, you know, when we get like a brief we can't handle, or we have, you know, even encouraging our team members and freelancers who get work that they necessarily can't handle, they are committing to offering that work to a woman or a person of color or a person who's differently abled or a person who is neurodiverse. And they have a setup where they have, you know, vetted lists of those folks who are really talented designers and writers and strategists and things like that. And they are their first port of call for referring work out. Because again, the problem is you have folks from dominant communities who get all the briefs, they get all the work into them, that they're, you know, partly as a result of their strong networks. And that work, you know, typically goes to their mates. But if they make a commitment to say, look, we're going to, you know, push this work out to folks who we know are really deserving, are really talented, but don't necessarily get, you know, the first stab at these pitches, I think that's a really great, you know, potential solution. Is like, cool, we're going to commit to this as a, you know, as an individual freelancer or as a company, and then kind of push this work into communities that don't often get them.
Again, it kind of goes back to your original point about that kind of like assessment and that watchdog. Is like, actually, when you do start to have real buy-in from certain companies, you realize there are a lot of things you can do that can like move the needle significantly, like referring work out that you have that's overflow work, not to your other white privately educated mates who own a different smaller agency, but you know, to folk from diverse backgrounds. And you do need that pressure or that buy-in from the top, because when people really truly sit down and want to look at solving these problems in massive transnationals, there's almost always a bunch of really cool innovative shit they come up with, where it's like, oh yeah, of course, we could just do this thing that might add like an hour's worth of work a week to our team, and it will like massively change the lives of hundreds of people each year.
Yeah, I think also too, like calling that stuff out. I mean, like, you know, we're part of, you know, various different networks of like, you know, agency owners, for example, you know, and I think there are limits to that, right? Like I've definitely queried this before, but like, you know, we see that like, if we don't turn up to like 6 p.m. drinks, you know, like, you know, every other month and stuff like that, then we don't get included in briefs. And like, we know who's in the room there, right? Like, you know, I'm often the speckle of pepper and a sea of salt in those rooms. And like, those are the people who are getting the briefs. So like, that's a conversation we need to be having with groups like Agency Collective and Pimento and some of these agency groups, to say like, okay, this is actually not the most meritocratic way to be passing work around, even though that is the way that happens. And I'm sure I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but like, you know, if you are actually committed to diversity, equity, inclusion, then maybe you should be start thinking about who's not in the room and how the work also goes to them, and actually some independent measure of their quality as an agency, other than do they show up to drinks after work? Because I don't think that's actually a disservice to clients as well. You know, like, you're not actually giving them the best work. You're just giving them the guy that you saw at 6 p.m. drinks the other night. So I think that's something like to really think about. And for us to, you know, in the marketing world, the agency world, to hold ourselves and our colleagues accountable to, is like, cool, there's lots of folks who aren't in the room here. How are you actually, you know, living up to that flashy DEI commitment that you posted on your website in 2020 in response to the protests and delivering on it?
I think it all kind of goes back to culture as well, because I think it's unfair to kind of crap on like the white males at the top, or like anybody that's been privately educated, because I think, you know, they were once children too, and they kind of just come into a system, and they've have these ways of thinking bestowed upon them. And I think it really is just a case of educating and trying to try and give them the opportunity to learn and be susceptible to understanding, like you say, Paul, that 6 p.m. drinks is not the benchmark for where work should be passed out. And I think that we do get, you know, some of these people that fit into that category that do understand, that do get it and are exposed to a range of cultures. So I I think that education is really important, and we just have to keep going forward and leading by example and trying to educate our peers in those spaces the best that we can. But ultimately, you know, it definitely stems from culture and a way of thinking, and it's a generational thing. And I don't think that it will be something that could be changed imminently. I definitely think over time it will happen, and I think it starts with those people that are bold enough to stand up and stand out and say, look, listen, this is not cool. So I look forward to that happening. I don't know if it will be in my lifetime, but fingers crossed, you know, for the generations to come.
Yeah, I think it's like, how do we actually like move past blame into responsibility?
Exactly,
which I think
yeah.
is much more active, and it enlists people. It like, you know, brings them into a cause and stuff like that. And like, we could spin ourselves in circles about who's to blame and what historical structures and stuff like that. And that's all very real and important analysis. But I'm more interested in like, cool, like, I, as a marketing agency leader, am responsible for making sure that, like, you know, things like what I just said don't happen, where, you know, the people who aren't in the room never get a shot at the briefs, that I'm at least invoking them, bringing them in, maybe bringing them into these networks, or at least telling those networks, hey, there's probably a better way for both you and for your clients to shuffle around this work, for example. And then the same applies to VCs, the same applies to, you know, tech startup founders who are hiring as well. Like, what is the responsibility that you're going to take to like move things forward and not just, you know, shuffle around blame?
I think the sort of note to end on is like, obviously we've spoken a lot about a really big structural stuff and massive things, which, you know, for the average small to medium business is like less, you know, tangible and actionable. But like, if you are on a smaller company, like, I think you really, and you care about this, it's just taking personal responsibility, because like, there's no quicker way for you to affect change than just going, okay, I'm not going to hire a white person for my next role. Like, and like, it's as simple as that. Like, and like, or you can maybe put a quota on the candidates that you get and guarantee that they're going to be a certain representative pool before you move forward with interviews. But like, that's something you can do immediately and you can do now. We've done as an agency, and our team is diverse and far stronger for it. Like, and you know, like, we don't have like a 40 page DEI policy. We've just hired diverse talent, and our agency's grown from it massively. So yeah, all of the big stuff around structure, education, like, yeah, keep fighting that fight. But for you, if you're looking for stuff you can do at the grassroots, like, just do that, just hire diversely. That will solve a lot of the problem and move the needle in a positive way.
That was a great discussion about diversity in tech. We covered a lot of ground in terms of hiring practices at startups, what VCs can do to kind of diversify their own industry and hold themselves accountable. Talking about everything like, you know, having more data and metrics in terms of understanding diversity in tech and just giving ourselves a baseline. We're now going to deepen the conversation by introducing Rocio Van Nierop, CEO of Latinas in Tech. They're a fantastic organization that started in Silicon Valley in 2014 and have since expanded to a large number of cities. Their goal is to create an industry where Latinas are well represented throughout all levels of the ecosystem by empowering them to be innovators and leaders. So yeah, we're super excited to have Rocio on the show today with us.
All right, guys, got a treat for you now. I'm very, very excited to be joined by Rocio Van Nierop, like that De Niro, as was just explained. Rocio, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation, William and Rebecca.
Such a pleasure to have you here. And for our audience, would love to just give a quick intro about yourself and about Latinas in Tech.
Absolutely. So my name is Rocio Van Nierop. I am co-founder and CEO of Latinas in Tech. And Latinas in Tech has been a movement for about 10 years. And we're about to be, next month, 5 years since we incorporated as a nonprofit, and I became CEO. We started as a group of 2 to 5 Latinas that found each other in Silicon Valley back when we were not common at all. And we were surprised that we were meeting each other. So we said, oh my God, we should keep doing this. So we got together once a month, and it was all about, you know, back then tech companies were bringing their products outside the US. Like, I'm talking about Meta, Netflix, Facebook. I was at Prezi. So they hired a person like me for each company. And the first markets where they were expanding internationally, the first language was Spanish because it was a pretty large market. So we were the people in charge of not only making sure that product is localized, but also that we have operations in the different countries, that we are compliant with the laws, that we have the staff, the support, customer support success, marketing, everything. It's like a mini startup inside another startup. And it was a difficult job being a Latina, the only Latina or Latino in the job in a company where you don't have anybody else, like not a lot of support network. So those meetings were really valuable to us to share paths, like how Netflix, how are you charging alternative payment methods in Mexico, or how to use Boleto in Brazil, PR agencies, recruiting people, passing on contacts. And that's how it became so valuable to us. It had that angle. It wasn't a place for complaining about any status quo. Like, we were just venturing into the wilderness. So that's why, with that philosophy, people just organically kept joining. More companies started building teams, and our teams started getting bigger. It wasn't one person. It was more like 10. So we went from 2 to 10 to 100 to thousands. And today we're 30,000 Latinas. Can you believe it?
Wow.
In 7 countries right now.
That's amazing. And you just shared there, you know, a bit about your inspiration to actually start Latinas in Tech. Can you talk a little bit deeper about some specific challenges that you faced in its early stages of actually putting together Latinas in Tech?
Yeah. The challenges that we had are a little counterintuitive. One would think, like, how did you build the momentum? How did you build the community? Mm-hmm. And to us, it was the opposite. How could you handle that momentum and that community and the attention from tech companies? It was way bigger than what we could handle. So we were a small group of 5. We call it founders or board members, working board members. And we had jobs, we had lives, we had kids. And all of a sudden, we were moms of this big thing. And some people, and then we started 10 years ago. So people get married, people relocate, people have babies, people get promoted, get different jobs. So it's not that easy to be here for a 10 years, like keeping this alive and growing. And I think the biggest challenge that I faced, because I like doing things well. And if I cannot do them well, I'd rather not do them. Because we had a very successful and high quality time in Silicon Valley, where we started, like having quality speakers, quality networking. It wasn't, you know, like you go somewhere and you only have people trying to sell you something. Like, it was all about us only, super private. It wasn't like, we did have journalists, but in the role of people, of Latinas in the tech journalism space, rather than just reporting what we were doing. So it was a safe space for people to talk. And I wanted to, like when we started opening chapters, I wanted to bring in that quality to the different chapters. Like, now we have a London chapter where you are. And we try to have that same quality that you got in Silicon Valley, that you get in Chicago, in New York, in Mexico City, in Sao Paulo. We also have had events in Rio. But it has been my challenge of being able to scale this, to be able to bring the secret sauce that we have in Silicon Valley anywhere in the world. And that has been the challenge. And of course, we're very lucky we have the supports of tens, like almost 100 companies over this period of time. And those are companies as large as Google, Meta, Twitter, Pinterest, say, like so many. But with that, it comes commitment, right? It's not just give me money and I just spend it whatever I want. It's the commitment of using it right as a nonprofit, not just to be profitable. Like, well, it's not about profitability, it's about change. So my goal as CEO is to make sure that we're actually changing the world the way we want to change the world, which is making hair fast buses in tech.
You know, 10 years, you've got a lot of cool times to pick from. What have been some of the sort of like most notable success stories and moments that you've just thought, yes, like this is it, we're doing it, this is what I signed up for?
I guess my response would be a little loaded and different angles, because there is my personal satisfaction, and that is really personal, that when I go to an event and at our summit, we have thousands of ladies, Latinas there and allies at our meetups. And when COVID wasn't there, and now that we're back live, when people come and share their personal life stories of, oh my God, your organization changed my life. Like, imagine somebody telling you that. And I get so lucky that I get to hear it so often. And of course, it's not me, it's the organization. But it just makes me so happy that when I go to bed, I just have a big smile in my pillow. Sometimes I even feel a little selfish, like, am I the junkie of that feeling? So that is my personal success, right? But then the real success is, I think we have been able to enable deep conversations, important conversations. We are not afraid of disrupt conversations. And when you're an employee, a tech employee, there are things you cannot say for fear of retaliation. Like, my company has these hiring practices or things, but I'm not an employee. And at this moment in time, Latinas in Tech have gotten to a scale that there's not a single sponsor that we can lose where we would even feel it. So that means I can say whatever I want, not whatever I want, but what I feel is right without the fear of retaliation of any sort. And if we get it, then we get it. But it's for those employees. So call it contingent workers that tech companies don't want to talk about. Call it the fact that Latinas are not growing and taking leadership positions at the same rate. The fact that we're less than 2% of a tech industry that in the US is so big, where they capitalize on the Latino market being $2.8 trillion of the economy of the US, the number one buyers and consumers of social media, but yet we're 1% of their employees when they're based in Silicon Valley, where we're almost 50% of the population. It just doesn't make sense. So I won't stop. And those are my successes, like this, where I get the microphone and I get to talk about this.
I think that when you just spoke about some of the barriers there that Latinas are facing in the tech industry, and even earlier when you spoke about your own personal time in Silicon Valley and some of those barriers, what strategies has that made you implement in Latina in Tech to try and address those challenges? What specific things are you doing in Latina in Tech to actually action those things?
I like the question. So because I spoke about my passion and my personal satisfaction on what we're doing, but how do we do it? It's not just one person, obviously. We're a team of 20 people with over 100 volunteers that are chapter leaders around the world. So this is where the real change happens. So if we want to see us being more than 2%, if we want to see us being in the decision-making table, if we want to see us being the CEO or an executive or a board member or the entrepreneur that gets millions of dollars in investment, if we want to do this fast, and with fast, I say we can change the system, but the system is not going to change tomorrow, not by your next paycheck, not next year, maybe not in your career's lifetime. So we, as a CEO, I'm going to try to change the system. But as a team, I think we believe that 70% of our work, I don't believe this is how it is, 70% of our work is dedicated to change the behavior of Latinas or what they can control to change the outcome. Because there are so many things they can personally control, like imposter syndrome, speaking up, focusing on shining. We have developed 9 different programs from which we have a mentorship program. We have weekly meetups online and live in the different chapters. We have our annual summit that is the largest technology conference in the world that addresses the Latino market. We have a professional development program. If we can train people into being and willing to be leaders, because culturally, it doesn't matter if you were born in London to Mexican parents or in Canada to Colombian parents, you still have the Latinity in you. And with all this beauty of the Latinity, it comes some learnings that are cultural, like calladita te ves más bonita. That means stay back and be quiet. And that's how a woman should behave. And heads down, focus on doing a great job because somebody's going to come and tap you in the back and give you something. And that is not how it works. That is not the rules of the game. And I'm trying to teach them the rules of the game that they are actually playing. And they're not taking advantage of because everybody else is. So this is what my team and our volunteers and the whole community is doing by providing information and educating them and empowering them. So that's where our real work is.
It's incredible and so much awesome work you're doing there. We earlier in the pod were discussing diversity in tech, and one of a truly awful stat that half of all women in tech drop out by the age of 35 in the UK. You've spoken a lot about what Latinas in Tech is doing, but what do you think specific companies within the tech industry need to do so that when diverse applicants from any walk of life do get there, they stick because there isn't a company culture that excludes them or minimizes them?
Yeah, that's a very difficult stat to process. So to put it in perspective, the 35 is the career, right? It's not just in one company. The number of years that a typical tech employee will stay at the same company, regardless of their ethnicity, is 2.5 years is in one company, because they will jump into another company. That's how you get better jobs, la, 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 la. But then, as you say, in your career, 35, and I experienced that personally, this is when you have babies. Like you start having babies age, say, late 20s, early 30s. So by the time you get pregnant, you're one of the young ones. By the time you have a baby, you totally aged out. So not only I got pregnant, took maternity leave, came back, and all of a sudden I wasn't part of the gang because I was much earlier. And it also happened when I moved from Boston to Silicon Valley. It is dramatically different, both tech companies, but the age difference, my CEO was younger than me, and I was in my early 30s. And I was the only mother in a 300 people company. So in the San Francisco office, I was the oldest, almost. There was one guy older than me. And I totally aged out in my early 30s. So here, and then imagine there were no other Latinos or Latinas for the matter. So there is a problem called ageism. This is ageism, and it's not particular to Latinas. This is for all genders and races, and it's very unfortunate. I'm hoping that as we move, and as CEOs age too, because the Silicon Valley boom happened for people about my age. And I'm aging, I'm now 43, and they are too. So at the end of the day, it's your gang that is still moving the boat. So I'm hopeful that at least we will be part of that conversation. I'm not part of that 20-something gang. I'm now, you know, the beautiful older people gang. But yeah, Latinas. Now, let me focus. Latinas and people of color. These 2.5 years that I said is way less. And this is where, yes, it is different for diverse employees. Because if you do not have the resources inside the company or around your life that can help you power up and speak up, you will be frustrated with your work. Therefore, you leave earlier. So both things. You might exit the tech industry before 35, but most importantly, you exit before the 2.5 years. And that, it's a breaker. So they might exit and move to a different industry altogether. And that's a sad thing, because the truth of the matter is that having diverse people is not a human thing to do, it's the business thing to do. The one that is missing out is the tech industry.
I agree with you on that. And I think that it's sad that we see employees, women especially, by the age of 35, kind of maxing out. And you've spoken about some of the support that companies like Meta have given you and how important that is as well. Do you feel that there's been any support from the government or any kind of like regulative bodies to support Latinas in tech?
That is a good question. And I have to say, it's the first time I get that question, and I need to elaborate the answer. So we definitely have had very friendly relationship with lawmakers, with like Mayor London Reed of San Francisco was our guest speaker like 3 or 4 years ago at one of our largest summits. Senator Alex Padilla, this is very US based, or at least my experience is mainly US, and our leaders in London, which is not a very old chapter, could tell you more of other countries. So I have had positive interactions with the mayor, with our governor team, with our senators, with different elected officials of different states. I had been invited to speak at the Hispanic caucus. That is where all the staffers and the lawmakers that are Latinos gather. So it's great because I get the opportunity to network with them, to interact, to convey my messaging. But I wouldn't say that there are programs that gives us grants, but we also haven't applied for any of that. As I said before, the problem with Latinas in tech has always been there's so much to grab. I don't want to call it grab, but so many opportunities that are laying down. Like there's Google, there's Meta, there's Pinterest, there's Airbnb. And man, you go on. And then you still have non-tech companies. You have banks, you have retailers, Nike, Home Depot. So many, I just cannot finish. So talking about grants, is still not even there yet. I wish we will get there one day, but that might mean that I exhausted my corporate partnerships.
it actually kind of quite nicely dovetails into our next question, which was like, you know, are there any grants you think should be set up maybe by Latinas in Tech or outside of Latinas in Tech to help this work? You know, you've taken on a huge amount of it as a nonprofit. Is there anything maybe states and governments should be doing in terms of grant making?
Absolutely. I mean, Latinos, people of color, not just female, but also female is like a double whammy. They need help. And if you follow the news, the policies that are happening are going backwards. I mean, the removal of affirmative action, pretending that there is equality, is a little insulting. No, it's very insulting. Like all the rhetorics that I've heard on TV are extremely sad. And I know lawmakers have a heart in one side, but then you see decisions from the Supreme Court being different. Yeah, it's like if you're a parent and you have a child that needs help, you give them that kid extra help. If that kid has a learning disability or is limping from a foot, you help them a little more than the rest. It's not the fault of the kid that is healthy. It's not the fault of the kid that can run faster. You still need to help out so that things even out. So it's sad that the strong kid won in certain conversations. Because of that, local governments can put in programs that can help that limping child at a local level, that can make up for the things they are missing out. Just like other communities, like the African American community, had a lot of past situations that have shaped their present. The same for us, for Latinas in Tech. About 90% of them have bachelor degrees or above. They're highly educated. But the vast majority is the first one going to college, the first one in their families. Do you think that we benefited from legacy admissions at Harvard? None of our parents went to college. None of the one, like by the time our great-grandparents could go to college, there was slavery in the US. They could not go to Harvard. So 30% of the admissions to those elite universities, our legacy, 30. So I'm sorry, I deviated to a different topic, but those are the things where to answer your question, what can governments do? Help these people directly, create programs where they can study STEM without the need of an affirmative action that is not even there.
Preempting all of our questions. Rebecca, go for it.
No, but that's perfect, because I think that it's an important conversation, and I think it's key for you to kind of highlight what exactly educational institutions can do to bridge that gap and provide equal opportunities for Latinas in STEM fields and other kind of technology related careers. So can you think of anything specifically aside from, you know, the legacy admissions that educational institutions could do? You spoke earlier about kind of influencing the mindset of Latinas.
It's a good question. Although in Latinas in Tech, we do not focus in education much. I don't give it the thought it deserves. But I'm going to give you one example that makes me think and hopefully will make you think too. So my friend Fabi, she is an undocumented immigrant. And she has a daughter who's graduating high school. And she's a great student. She's extremely smart. Her dad doesn't know how to read and write. And the mom doesn't speak English. Do you think she has the same opportunities other kids had to get where she's at being a straight A student? Absolutely not. She got admitted to where she applied to, but she couldn't go because she doesn't have the money, but because of affirmative action. So what could the educational institution could do to help people like her? And she is a smart girl. Not all girls and boys are, you know, very high IQ like she is. I am not, for sure. So we do need extra help. If I don't have the parent that can sit down with me and do homework with me when I'm in elementary school because that person doesn't even speak English or read, I need help. So I think that institutions need to look into those disadvantages. Not everybody goes back to a happy family with a hot meal in the table. Many don't even have internet. Many, like this girl, they sleep all of them in one same room. And they had no computers or internet at home. So what this country needs to thrive is beautiful minds in general. We want a girl like her being an astronaut. We need one of her to be a CEO. All she needs is the resources. The University of Stanford created a program that I really like. So primarily Professor Porras, the one that coined the term BHAGs, the big hairy audacious schools, and the writer of From Good to Great. He's Mexican-American. He's a professor at Stanford Business School. And him and other professors, most or some of Hispanic origin, but they all got together and they thought, look, the Stanford Business School has created billionaires. Most of the millionaires and billionaires that we've created are white males. And there's no Latinos in this business school because number one is expensive and number two is hard to get in. And you do need to have a pristine track record in education to make it here. So what if we condense all this amazing information, not about giving you a degree, it's about giving you the information so that you can be a billionaire. So they created this LAE program only for Latinos. And there are other programs for other demographics. Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative. So this is where Stanford puts in all this information into CEOs with high potential that are all Latinos in the hopes that from there we can scale and get new Latino billionaires. So this is an example of a pristine institution is doing to help a specific demographic. And really what they want is to change the nation's shape of wealth.
Yeah, we work with a lot of nonprofits in the US focused around education and mm-hmm. like they all have exactly the same thing. Just like it's just insane the untapped potential and again just how much it's a win-win for everyone. If that Latino now goes creates a $1 billion company, it's good for the economy. Like everyone wins. So like to yeah. not give that opportunity is just, it's dumb on every single level that it could be, even if you only care about capitalism and finance. Like, you know, it's forgetting the moral question, it's just silly where we're wasting entire generations of kids because we're not giving them
absolutely.
The tools that they
need. Yeah, yeah. And at the end of the day, a high IQ or a low IQ is not a racial thing. So you can be extremely smart, like this girl. What you don't have is the resources. Like another example, I asked her, what do you want to be? And she's like, maybe I can study nursing. I'm not, but think big. What do you want to be? Maybe you want to be a nurse of a cardiologist. And I'm like, why don't you want to be the cardiologist? You know, that is a part of the Latina thing playing. Like, let me try little. Because she has the brain of doing whatever she wants. Of course, then also you have to pay for it.
That quite nicely dovetails into to our next point, which we just wanted to ask you, you know, as the co-founder of Latinas in Tech, what advice would you have for, you know, any Latinas who are aspiring to be in the tech industry and pursue a career in it?
If a young Latina is in that moment of choosing what she wants to do, and hears of the stats that only 1% makes it to the tech industry, and from those almost nobody gets it to a decision-making position or an executive position, it's really diminishing. It's like, why should I try, right? Like, that's not even my place. Like, the chances of me succeeding are slim. As you said, the chances of me dropping out of the career are pretty high. Why should I invest all this? The thing is that you can own your own outcome. You should ignore the stats because they don't need to apply to you if you set yourself aside. Because I would like to put myself as an example. Call me naive. When I started in this path, I just didn't see stats. They were not even stats. There was not even a 1%. I've always been a little overconfident. And so I went straight into doing my thing, not looking to the sides. I never even noticed. Some other people said, did you notice somebody said this? And I was like, well, so is that bad? Like, I just didn't listen to things, which is not good for awareness for people. But because of that, I never saw myself as different. And even like, for example, my accent is obvious. And it was more obvious when I was younger. And to me, it's like, yeah, I speak a different language. Actually, English is my third language. How many do you speak? That's how I always saw things. And then a lot of people doubt of their education. And when I first started working here and I had to hire people in my field, I realized that what I learned in another country from my degree was what the people applying with master degrees knew, but not from college. So I was not at all underqualified in the very, very opposite way. I had what I needed. So I trusted that. So what my advice to people is to stop wasting their time doubting themselves and flip everything. You can doubt your accent, or you can say, haha, I have an accent because it's a statement that I speak more than one language. Aha, I'm diverse. That means I bring in different perspectives. And I trust my education. I know my stuff. And because of that trust, I think that I managed to advance as fast as I could. Now, I do acknowledge, and I should absolutely, and I want to be very empathetic, like there is privilege amongst diverse people. If you put two Latinas, one that looks one way, another one looks differently, both from the same background, both from the same town, where one is lighter, the other one is darker, the lighter one will succeed more because more doors open. That is so sad. That is absolutely sad. So maybe more doors were open to me unconsciously, and I acknowledge that it might have not been as easy to other people.
One thing I did want to ask and wanted to find out more about is any kind of exciting initiatives or anything that Latinas in Tech has coming up. What have you guys got going on that people can come to or find out about or tap into?
Latinas in Tech grew a lot in the last 2 years. We launched from these 9 programs, we probably launched about 6 of them. So they are babies. Like, we literally had our first executive development program launched with the company Discord, and it went really great. So I'm really excited to see how our mentorship program shapes, how our executive development program shapes. Our summit that was in May brought in an outstanding number of people from out of town. So people mostly from the U.S., but from New York, from Miami, like they flew just for this. And I never thought that was going to be the case. So it is clear to me that next year is going to be even bigger and better. By the way, mark your agendas. May 16, 17, Palace of Fine Arts, San Francisco. And probably we'll do side things in the Lucasfilms campus. So I'm really excited. So to me, what excites me about our programs and what we do is what is to come this year. So we planted the seed last year and the year before, and this year and the next year is when it's going to flourish, like big time. We landed very big partnerships. We're about to launch a very exciting new partnership with Summa Wealth and tackling financial education this is another interesting factoid. So because I mentioned Latinas are the first one to go to college, the ones that I have in Latinas in Tech, they're the first ones to go to college, therefore they're the first ones creating meaningful wealth. But because of our backgrounds, it's not like we come with a financial planner advice. So let's talk about how do you manage your stock options, ownership of stock of tech companies, wealth management, college education, saving for retirement, and things like this, investing your money. So this is something that is completely foreign to our people. So this partnership with Summa will really help us out.
Awesome. There's so much exciting stuff coming down the pike. And just last question, you know, for folk that are interested in all of that, where can they find it online? Where can they keep up to date with all the cool events, all the cool partnerships that are going on?
You can find us at latinasintech.org. There you can register. Everything is free. You can select your chapter. We have 22 chapters, but you do not need to have a chapter to be a member. So if you're in Bolivia, you can still join and attend all the virtual programs. You can find us in every social media channel, including Thread, the newly launched yesterday, Twitter by Meta. We are on Instagram, and our LinkedIn group is enormous and is growing super fast. So you can find us everywhere by Latinas in Tech.
Amazing. Rocio, thank you so much for joining us on the pod to discuss diversity in tech and what the tech sector can be doing better. Really appreciate your time, and thank you so much for such a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, William and Rebecca. Such a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, give us 5 stars, give us a like, give us a subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you get your podcasts. That way we can bring on more great guests like Rocio and have great discussions like this one today about diversity in tech. So love y'all. Thanks so much for your time.